Good morning. I'm Jeff Beckwith, Executive Director of the Massachusetts. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the 15th COVID-19 briefing that the Baker-Polito administration is providing for municipal chief executive officers here in Massachusetts. We'll get right into the program. We're very pleased to have you here, and Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, who's been a champion of connecting all of you with the information necessary to lead during this time, is going to lead the program. Lieutenant Governor, thank you again for all your efforts.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining. As we discussed last week, we have invited Commissioner Riley as well as his CFO, Bill Bell, to be here to discuss what was released last week, which is guidance for the fall opening of our schools and support to communities to get kids back into the classrooms and into in-person learning. I'd like the commissioner to review those guidelines and talk about the medical team that he put together to advise DESE in establishing this guidance. Tremendous effort and a great team of people that really led an effort that very extremely complicated but very important to the success of our students and our schools across our Commonwealth. I'm going to turn it over to the commissioner. He will be able to address questions from the members, and then we will get into our usual program where I have some updates. Our team is here from DPH as well as DLS. And our legal office to address questions that you have today. So with that, thank you, Commissioner, for spending some time with us. And I know you have a hard stop at 10:30.
Thank you, LG. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all today. I just want to kind of run through the process, where we've been, and what next steps are so that everyone has an understanding of where we're going in education in Massachusetts. First and foremost, this is a different guidance document than we put out in the past. Typically, our guidance documents come from only experts in the education field. In this particular case, we've had to rely pretty heavily on the medical field as well. And to that end, we've been able to access regularly the Governor's Command Center Medical Advisory Board, made up of both physicians and healthcare experts. We also have Dr. Sandy Nelson, who's an infectious disease specialist at MGH, as well as on the Harvard Medical School Board. She's also advising two of the four pro sports teams on their reopenings, as well as Dr. Lloyd Fisher, who's the incoming president of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He represents over 2,000 pediatricians across the Commonwealth, and they have wholeheartedly endorsed our initial guidance. I do want to say that that is what we have so far. It's the initial fall guidance. We will be putting out the final fall guidance later in July, which will have additional information on it. But for our initial fall guidance, the state's pediatricians have wholeheartedly endorsed our plan. And basically what we're asking districts to do is, first and foremost, to plan for what reopening school would look like, in-person instruction, given some unique, specific medical parameters. And so we know there are a few things that we need students and staff to do to make sure that we keep our schools as safe as possible. Those things include mask wearing. We're asking all kids and staff to wear masks. Kids grade 2 and above have a mandatory mask requirement, and we're strongly encouraging our kindergarten and first graders to wear masks. All staff should be wearing masks, and all students, whether it's through K through 12, need to wear masks if they're on a bus. And so that's one part of the equation. Another part of the equation is hand cleaning and hand sanitizing. And we've set out specific guidelines around the ethanol level or the isopropanol level for hand sanitizer and the amount of time to spend washing your hands and different times throughout the day when kids should be doing that. Those are two of the three things. And then the third thing is this idea of physical distancing. And what we're saying is we're asking schools to aim for 6 feet, which is the CDC guidelines, although they've started to come off that a little bit, but no less than 3 feet of distance, which is what the World Health Organization suggests. And again, I think what you're seeing is the CDC is starting to change its guidelines to be more practical for schools. But at the end of the day, what we're telling schools and districts is to plan for in-person instruction, aiming for 6 feet of distance, but no less than 3 feet. And that's going to cause them, and we've asked them to do a feasibility study. All of the school districts should be doing that as we speak over the next few weeks to figure out how many desks, for instance, can be in any one classroom to see what the need is as far as your schedule. We believe that there will be many districts that will be able to, even with these guidelines, just bring their kids completely back to school without making many changes because their class sizes are still within the realm of the 3 foot guidance. We think there may be some schools that will have to stand up additional classrooms. For instance, if town A only can get 22 kids in a fourth grade classroom and their average class size is 24, well, we know they're going to have to stand up another classroom in their library or in their auditorium to be able to reduce class sizes down to make it work. And there may be a smaller number of districts who can't make it work because either the classroom space is too small or their class size numbers are too big, and they may need to default down to a hybrid model, for instance, or what have you. But at the end of the day, we're really asking all districts to do this feasibility test to see what can be done about bringing all of our kids back when school starts in the fall, which is usually, as you know, right before Labor Day or right after. With all of that said, we're asking districts to be prepared for 3 contingencies. First and foremost is the in-person that we just discussed. The second one is a hybrid model where, for example, half of the students could go into school at one time while the other half were learning remotely, and then they'd switch on the next week. And then the last model is this idea of a continuation of remote learning. If, for instance, there's a second spike in the virus, that, you know, we need districts to be prepared for all contingencies. And so we're asking them to submit a plan with these 3 specific type of plans within it in early August, which says we're going to be ready no matter what happens. Regarding the remote planning, the administration has put forward a $25 million matching grant for technology to try to make sure that some of those districts that still need help with their technology can have access to some of that money. We're going to take it on kind of a need basis and a financial basis. We'll look at how we distribute those dollars. But that will go a long way towards plugging any technology gaps that we have in the state. The other part that we show on the continuum, which I don't have in front of you, but is this idea of another box beyond the 3 plans that people have to prepare for, which is this idea of return to school without restrictions. And we're just not there yet. That would be perhaps after a vaccine is developed or after specific treatments come to the fore that make it so that the virus is not as problematic as it is now. So we're only talking about being prepared for 3 possibilities: remote learning, a hybrid model, and the one that all districts should be working on now, the feasibility of in-person learning, given the new safety requirements that the medical professionals have given us. When we send out information to superintendents, we're talking first and foremost about the health and safety requirements. We're giving them information about the reopening plans, and we're letting them know that there's more guidance coming. I told you earlier that we have put out initial fall guidance. A more comprehensive document is coming out later in July, which will include a lot more information. Obviously, there are a multitude of factors to consider, and we're trying to run down as many of those as we can so schools really kind of understand the rules of engagement when we go back to school. You know, at the end of the day, the safe return of as many kids for in-person schooling is our goal. We've based this on the medical evidence that's out there. We are always open to new research and medical evidence that may be coming out over the summer, and we'll adjust accordingly. Obviously we've got to kind of, as the pediatrician said, balance the risk of not sending kids to school with the risk of sending kids to school. And the pediatricians believe that right now, if we do certain things, and that is there's no one silver bullet, they'll tell you, but if we do the hand washing, if we do the distancing, and we do the mask wearing with regularity, schools are a low transmission place, and that they're safer than many other places out there, and that kids should go back to school. And that is kind of the judgment of the medical professionals. We understand that there are worries from families, and we're going to try to get the word out. I know the doctors are going to be writing an op-ed and have been working on sending out guidance to their fellow physicians about how to talk to families about it when children show up at the doctor's office. As a side note, we are concerned that some kids haven't kept up with their vaccinations. So that's something we're trying to push on families to make sure that they stay current with their vaccinations. Additionally, we're strongly recommending that all students get the flu vaccine when it becomes available, earlier in the fall. We know that the flu mirrors the coronavirus. And so to be able to have the kids be vaccinated against that will cut down on a lot of confusion. So Massachusetts overall does a pretty good job with their kids getting vaccinated, but we really want to kind of send the word out. So whatever you guys can do to help us with that. But again, the pediatricians say it's those three things. It's the mask wearing, the distancing, and the hand washing or hand sanitizing that are key. I would add a fourth thing, which is we're going to, and this is a very anti-education thing, which we believe in compulsory attendance, but we're going to really recommend that teachers and students stay home when they're sick. Right, we think that that's the best policy, and because of that, we're going to try to offer some relief to schools regarding attendance requirements and things like that. We think first and foremost, we've got to get the safety squared away. Now, when the doctors talk about why they think schools are safer than other places, they're looking at a lot of the research that's come out on children, and the research has been pretty clear so far that schools haven't played a major role in transmission of the virus. Number one, in general, kids have a lower rate of infection than adults. And if they do get it, they're less likely to experience it in a severe way. That is, oftentimes kids are asymptomatic. They get it. They don't even know they had it. And this is the most interesting one. And again, the research is emerging, but the preliminary research that's out there suggests that unlike what some people had bandied about in the beginning, who said that children were super spreaders. In fact, it looks like that may actually be the opposite. The children are less likely to spread the virus than adults at this time. And again, that's just preliminary research that's out, but the doctors feel pretty compelled by it as they made their adjudication that they think that kids are better off in school in the fall than not. And so when we think about these plans, we're asking people to submit them to us in early August, and we will work with them to support them. We've got all kinds of guidance that's coming out, including guidance around things like athletics and transportation, right? Because we know we're probably not going to be able to have full buses. We're letting the doctors kind of work that out, but we're waiting to see. I know there are some states that have said their buses can be full. Well, maybe that's what the doctors will say, but until we get the medical experts, we won't have that guidance. We do hope to have it in the next few weeks. Athletics is another thing which we're going to rely heavily on the medical professionals to kind of sort through. I can tell you the MIAA has a task force that's been up and running to look at everything. Will we be able to have athletics or not? If so, will it be all athletics? Or is it more likely, for instance, that we'll have golf than we will wrestling or football, right, which are more close contact? I don't know the answer to those questions right now. But the doctors are going to kind of advise us, and that's what we're going to use for our best practices. And that's kind of the highlights of where we're going. Obviously, a lot more work to do, and I recognize that that the data is incredibly strong in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts has been called out as one of the few states that's been able to contain the virus. But what I've said overall is we as an educational community have to be nimble and be ready for all possibilities because we just don't know. And that's hard for us as educators. We have a fairly simple formula that we followed for a long time, which is we start the budget process, and you guys know this, in April. High schools start doing their schedules. We go through the budget in May, and at the end of June, we usually have it finalized. And then, you know, we're ready and prepared over the summer to start school. This year, because the trajectory of the virus is unknown, and because the budget is still unknown, we're going to have to be ready to kind of operate and move on a dime, which is why I've asked districts to prepare for those three possibilities to date. And with that, I think, Jeff, should I take questions? What's the best format?
Yes, we have actually, as the attendees know, we take questions in the chat box, and there are a few questions covering a couple of topics that have already popped up for you. The first one has to do with how you would recommend schools deal with children who refuse to wear masks and the issue of those who believe who are anti-mask, and maybe it's a political feeling, whatever it is, parents who wouldn't want their children to be cooperative and wear a mask. How are you planning on advising schools?
So we're not trying to be punitive with the mask wearing. We do recognize that there will be some kids, a small number of kids who have medical issues that don't allow them to wear masks. For those kids whose families don't want them to wear a mask but don't have a medical issue, our guidance is probably going to be to have a conference with the families and explain to them that why masks are important. And this is what the pediatricians were talking about just yesterday, where it's the mask is both for the child, but it's also for everybody else in the community. And we're asking people to work together because we know that the more kids that wear masks, the less likely we are to transmit or have any issues. And so I think being cautious is important. I don't want to be punitive on this case, but I think at the end of the day, the doctors are very confident, and Dr. Lloyd Fisher speaks about this publicly, that the children are able to get used to the masks, and you'd be surprised that they'll, even with the mask breaks that we're going to give kids, that, you know, we just want to have conversations with families to really strongly encourage them to do that.
There's a one, I think, coming out of this, one of the suggestions would be to have information materials to make it easier for schools to communicate the mask issue, since some communities are reporting that there are there's a bit of a movement to protest against mask wearing in public. So thank you. Another question is, communities are doing their feasibility plans for in-person teaching. There's a question about whether you would consider allowing a temporary regional approach for public school space, where two towns in different districts might share students provided all the parties agree. Have you thought about that?
I have not heard of that unique circumstance yet, but I think we're willing to talk to all communities about possibilities. We're looking to help communities to figure out what works best for them, so we'd certainly entertain the idea.
And if communities want to include that in their feasibility study, should they contact you and talk with you more about that beforehand?
Well, I think what I'd ask them to do is just do the feasibility study for their own community first, and then kind of do an appendix and have, by the way, this is our feasibility study if we work with this other town. So kind of do two mini versions of it so I could see both.
Thank you on that. The one of the other issues, and I know that we have CFO Bill Bell on, the administration has actually provided an announcement regarding additional CARES Act funds to go directly to districts to help deal with the expense of fitting schools for in-person learning. Is it possible to give just a brief summary of that, the timing of those funds and the distribution of those funds?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Commissioner, you want me to run with that?
Please.
Okay. Morning, everyone. I'm Bill Bell. I run the financial operations for DESE, as Jeff said. Just quickly, we are in the process of working with the Executive Office for Administration and Finance to develop grant awards for all of the municipal districts, regional districts, and charter schools to provide a per person per student allocation of $225 per student. The numbers are based on the FY21 foundation enrollment student population that was used to build the governor's budget request this past January. As you all know, the city of Boston and Plymouth County also got direct allocations outside of the state funding that the governor and ANF are administering. So that municipality and county will be responsible for covering the school needs within those territories, those areas. We are working right now to develop and put up four school districts to apply. A grant opportunity, we'll have that available, I would say, within probably the next, sometime next week. We're just developing what we need to do to get it live. Funding is, broad strokes is available, similar to all the municipal relief you have now, to fund the same things needed within school systems to respond to the pandemic emergency, and over and above what sort of existing budgetary funds should be supporting. So we're very encouraged to really support and thank the Lieutenant Governor and Governor for making it available to school systems, particularly as the Commissioner said, with the uncertainty as it relates to the finalization of the General Appropriations Act. We're all just trying to do the best we can to try to get resources to folks who need them to respond and being able to open schools properly. Thank you. And any questions, folks, your school system, they all know how we sort of run our grant program. So any questions sort of can go right into, obviously myself, but also our grant folks, and we can respond quickly to them.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm checking to see if there are other school-related questions in the chat function. I think, Commissioner, you did an excellent job of providing the overview because we don't have more specific questions. It is so challenging, the position you're in, dealing with so many uncertainties. I know we've talked about this directly ourselves, just about planning for not knowing what's happening with the virus, what's happening with the budget, what's happening with the number of people who feel comfortable going back into school, and what the range of retrofitting and scheduling and reformatting is needed in school districts. So there's a lot going on right now that you're managing.
Well, thanks for having me. Happy to come back on when you need me. And you know, we're going to keep managing down all the questions and hopefully get a good result for our kids.
Thank you, Commissioner, very much. And we appreciate all of the communication from your office, and we will help to push out all of the information that you provide to the schools, also to the municipal side as well. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, folks. Take care.
Thank you, Bill. Okay. Lieutenant Governor, we can now go back to your part of the program. I'm going to unmute you. Let's see. Just trying to unmute the Lieutenant Governor. Here we go.
Okay, can you hear me now? Yes, all right, so I've got the team with me today. Dr. Madoff is here. Jana Ferguson, the Assistant Commissioner, is also here. Senior Deputy Commissioner Sean Cronin is here, and Elizabeth Denniston from our legal office. First, I obviously want to thank again the Commissioner Riley and many of you who have worked closely with DESE to see this guidance come available. The work in the next weeks ahead is really important, and I was reviewing some of the materials and to see like floor plans and the visuals about how to do this is really important, and it's very similar to how we handle the reopening for industry sectors and businesses within industry sectors, and how much time we've spent with all of you determining the industry protocol and the templates and the checklists and the down to the details of how to make a workplace safer for the customer, for the worker, and transferring that kind of systematic approach to our schools is really important. And it really, I think at this moment in time in Massachusetts, with the data that we have that shows that the rate of spread is way down, zero deaths reported yesterday, I feel really grateful that so many worked hard for this moment, down to the individual citizen, taking seriously compliance around distancing and face coverings and hygiene, workplaces, municipal government, you know, the whole team of medical professionals out there, just an amazing effort to get to this moment. And so I feel grateful, but I feel very anxious because we want to make sure that this moment is not fleeting and that it continues to be the environment that persists here in the Commonwealth with a low rate of COVID positives. So we all need to continue to do our part, and we need everyone to continue to message compliance, enforcement, and the individual responsibility that's so key to this as people move about more freely and do more within their day-to-day lives. I want to give a big shout out to the local boards of health. You have been amazing throughout this whole process. In addition to all of the response during the high incidence of COVID positive, to tracing and tracking and following through with the process around testing and tracing, and your enforcement of the rules that we've put out there has been extraordinary. You have been a strong partner, and we thank all of you for your continued effort. I want to just start with an update on economics, because now as more of these businesses reopen, we want more businesses to be able to reopen and to help bridge these gaps that you see, especially among micro businesses and smaller businesses in your communities, in your main streets, in your downtowns. And so we took another look at our economic development bill, and we thought about repositioning certain elements of it to address equity and to address recovery. So it's a $275 million package, and we were able to share this with the legislative co-chairs and the committee last Friday, and ask them to consider this as they process the economic development bill, hopefully before the end of session, which is 31 days from today. And we added monies to neighborhood stabilization, community development, financial institutions, as well as microbusiness grants, as an example of three programs that can quickly turn the dollars into action and get them in the hands of community development corporations, into your hands, as well as into the hands of small businesses. So there's a short game here and then a long game. And the short game is to get those dollars working as fast as possible. So those are some of the tweaks we made to the programs in the economic development bill. And of course, when we filed our bill, we included the housing choice legislation. We cut and pasted and inserted it right into the economic development bill. And we are very grateful to your leadership in helping us adopt the tools needed to produce more housing. We're very concerned about the housing crisis. We were before COVID hit. It's now more pronounced than ever as people are struggling to find affordable housing in this Commonwealth. And the housing choice bill will unlock such opportunity in your communities to create the housing that's needed here in the Commonwealth. So that's out there in your advocacy. I hope that you will work with the Economic Development Committee and certainly make that a priority before the end of the legislative term. I also want to talk about emergency rental and mortgage assistance. I don't know if you're hearing from landlords and renters in your communities, In March, we announced a $5 million emergency fund. We know that we needed to do more in this area, so we redirected CARES Act funding, some funding at DHCD and other federal sources, to announce yesterday a $20 million commitment to emergency rental and mortgage assistance. So we will work with our RAFT administering agencies like Wayfinders, Metro Housing Boston, Community Teamwork. You know who they are in your area, to get those dollars into the hands of the people who need it the most. In terms of our reopening, we talked in our last call about phase three. We continue to look at the data, and that will determine the start of phase three. You'll most likely be hearing from us before the end of this week, maybe even tomorrow, around the beginning of phase three. The guidances for the industries within phase three are being finalized and will be shared with all of you in advance, so that you can review those and have a familiarity with them before phase three. Businesses are eligible to open, so I would put you on notice for that, as well as a couple of orders. The gathering order is under review as well. We're looking at other states and seeing how they moved ahead in their next phase regarding the gathering order. You will be hearing from us on that as well this week. I would like to address the travel guidance, working with our public health officials, monitoring what's happening in other states. We have updated our travel guidance. If you look at the map of the country and you look at the Northeast, you can see that New England and New York and New Jersey have managed the virus spread. And we feel it is appropriate for us to exempt residents and people coming into Massachusetts from the New England states or New York and New Jersey. But the 14-day quarantine will still apply to people coming from states other than New England, New York, and New Jersey. So you will see that that's effective today. So that might be of note to you. I also want to just give a big thank you, and it really underscores the importance of having the relationship with MMA, MAPC, as well as each one of you. You help us do our jobs better, and repeatedly on these calls, you've talked to us a lot about cash flow and the next fiscal year. Last week, we had Catherine Hornby on to talk about the budget and what we envision over the next couple of weeks. You know, obviously, mid-July, when tax revenues come in, is a really important time for us to monitor and see what we're dealing with for the next fiscal year, longer term. But in order to address cash flow, I want to thank North Andover Town Manager Melissa Murphy Rodriguez, as well as Mayor Dan Rivera from Lawrence, to help us understand how to address some of these cash flow issues. And one idea came with the GIC deferral. So for the communities that are in the GIC system, we are allowing the deferment of the GIC payments for the first quarter fiscal year 21. This deferral is approximately $63 million per month, or approximately $190 million in total. And that won't have any effect on our cash flow, because we're just going to defer those payments to the end of the fiscal year. So for the beginning part of fiscal year 21, we feel that this relief will help during those first few months of the fiscal year. We want to thank you for bringing that idea to us. It's just one more tool to put into the toolbox to give these communities that are member GIC member communities some relief. I know Jana Ferguson is on as well. She did send a letter out yesterday to you to thank your public health departments and also just underscore how important it is to work with you on enforcement of the governor's orders. It is very difficult. We know people's patience are being tried, whether you're a small business owner trying to make ends meet, or you have a community that is interested in more outdoor gatherings and celebrations, or you're trying to do something that you know is inconsistent with what the governor's orders are. And it's a challenge, but we want to work with you and support you. And that's why the communication was made, just to repeat how important this time period is. I started off my remarks with how grateful we are to be in this position, but we certainly don't want to be in a different place or a far different place toward the end of the summer as we begin school. People maybe return back to the office more so. We want to keep moving forward. And this cautious, slower approach and the vigilance that's needed to help Massachusetts remain in a good place relative to the virus requires all of us to continue to do our parts. We will be there to support you and work with you. So having said that, I am sure we have some questions or comments in the chat room, and the team is ready.
Excellent. Yes, we do. Thank you for all of those announcements. You did start to talk about the timing of moving from phase two to phase three. And there was a question about when that might happen, but you're saying there may be an announcement or an update on that tomorrow or later in the week.
Yes, that's correct. And again, as we've said before, we look at the data, and you look at the data every day at 4 o'clock when it's released, and the data looks good. And so we want to continue to see what today looks like and tomorrow, and we may have the announcement for you as early as tomorrow or Friday.
And what the administration, what you had announced earlier, was that the earliest phase three would start would be the 6th of July. Is that correct?
That could be Monday the 6th of July, yes.
That would be the earliest, okay. Well, we look forward to that update later in the week. Here's a question on what's the timeline for decisions on applications for the Shared Streets program?
Say that one again. I don't see it in my chat. So.
It was up higher up in terms of what's the timeline for decisions on applications for the Shared Streets program?
Okay, well, those applications are obviously available to you, and it's a rolling decision process. So if there's a community that's applied and you're anxious to have access to those funds, I'd like to know who you are so we can follow through for you, but it's rolling so that you can start to put those dollars to work. So okay. Jess Bellevue is on the call. Maybe Jess, you can respond privately to that chat or work with Jeff and his team to address that particular concern.
Excellent, thank you. Next question has to do with if early in-person voting for the state primary and general election is approved, could the possibility of voting on Saturday and Sunday be made optional rather than required because some communities, even with funding from the state, don't have the personnel to be open during the weekends?
Yeah, I don't know if anyone from legal is on. We certainly want to give communities as much flexibility around this and voters opportunity to participate in the process. I don't have the answer in terms of what's feasible for that. Does anyone on my team have an answer for that? And if not, we will review that and get back to you.
I'm not sure I see Elizabeth as a speaking panelist, so we'll potentially have to have her get back to us, and we can share the answer out to everyone.
Okay.
Let's see. Next is a question about the state parks have opened and have their picnic tables out. This person's city won't put the tables at the park because they say the state guidelines say tables need to be disinfected after every use. And is that an accurate view of the outdoor guidelines? I know that there's if they're wooden picnic tables, they do not need to be disinfected. I know that much, but I'm not sure about the others. So the question is the state requiring the cleaning of picnic tables after each use?
I wonder if the public health folks can speak to this. I don't have that guideline in front of me. I don't know if Jess does. That's who's on the call from my office. And I wonder if that, if the cleaning supply is available, if that can be done through self-compliance, or is that something that you need in a local employee to monitor, which would be very difficult to do so. Mm-hmm. Jaina or Dr. Madoff, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Thank you so much. The question's a good one. It's something that we have also been hearing from our local health officials, as you can imagine, questions about, you know, how often things need to be cleaned and who needs to clean them are really all part of how, you know, the hygiene piece of the reopening standards. The guidance that I don't have it open in front of me either. I apologize for this, but I do know that they, that guidance is not specific about who must do the cleaning. So if the wipes are made available, then the patrons or the people who are using those facilities can wipe them down afterwards.
Very good. Thank you very much. And it's welcome to the briefings, Jim.
Thank you.
The next, I do note, and I'll just make this comment because I see it in the chat, that there are concerns regarding the masks in the schools. And the message, one of the messages is that children, if children are less likely to pass or spread COVID-19, then that could actually be an argument used to say then the mask is unnecessary. So I think our members in commenting on the chat are encouraging providing some good messaging for the schools to be able to share with parents to ensure there's a consistent tie-in with the arguments about going back to school, but also the necessity of wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the point is well taken. The guidance says, I believe, second grade and older, the requirement is for a face covering. Cloth is preferred. You can also have a waiver if there's a medical condition, and face shields are also a way to develop a barrier for a student who might find that more comfortable for multiple reasons. Could be a disability, or it could just be a comfort and a more feasible approach to providing that barrier. And the shields provide a facial expression. So maybe for younger children, that would be important for both the educator as well as the student. We have received much input, and I'm sure Dr. Madoff can underscore this even more, that there's no one thing that is the key tool. There's multiple things that need to happen in order to reduce the spread of the virus. And because asymptomatic people can be spreaders of the virus, the things that are most critical are face coverings to protect you from someone else and to protect someone else from you if you are asymptomatic and carry the virus. The face covering is essential. It's an essential tool, as well as the distancing. And you've heard from Commissioner Riley and the team that advised him in the document of guidance that was put out, talked about that 3 to 6 feet as being the distance that droplets can release and spread to another person. So that's why the distance with the mask becomes an even more potent tool. But the face covering is really important. And we will work with all of you to continue to message that as we live with the virus. It is going to be with us for a while, and it can come back, as you have seen in other states where they have not been perhaps as vigilant about the enforcement of our safety standards and monitoring the industry protocols and their adherence in workplaces and the social guidance that people need to adhere to when they go out and about, really important. And the coverage has been that the Northeast has been sort of the more compliant part of the country. And maybe that's because from the beginning, we've messaged that face coverings are essential, and that has become more of a habit for people to incorporate face coverings into their day-to-day life. It's like part of your dress that you just go out and you just have it as part of you. And in other parts of the country, not starting with that message makes it difficult, right, for people to then have to adjust.
Yeah.
And that could be one of the things that's a differentiating factor between where we are here in the New England and where other places are in the country.
I think that that was as good a health update as we could have received, even from Dr. Madoff, Lieutenant Governor. So we'll go right to another question. Thank you. Couple questions on the 14-day quarantine for individuals who are out of state. One question was about how the enforcement is happening. And then the second question is advice and guidance for municipalities as employers if an employee goes on vacation to Florida, for example, and then comes back. Should that person be quarantining for 14 days before returning to work?
Yes, and Dr. Madoff can speak to this as well, but the 14-day quarantine applies to all places outside of New England, New York, and New Jersey. And this can change if some of these areas around us develop hotspots. We would want to reduce the inflow of people coming from those hotspot areas to Massachusetts. So the answer to the question is, if someone is returning from a state that is not New England and not New York or New Jersey, the 14-day quarantine applies after returning.
Thank you. And that means employees should be very mindful about where they go and what their vacation plans are to not...
I think this is a huge opportunity for us in Massachusetts to promote local. You know, there's so many wonderful opportunities within Massachusetts and New England to drive to and visit to. And think about that when you're making your plans with your family. For sure, a business travel is a different issue, but a lot of employers are adopting work from home because of these travel restrictions. And you know, we're still very much in the mix of this, and the quarantining is really important tool as well. Not the only one, but one of the tools that we need in order to reduce the spread.
A couple of quick questions on the reopening. When do you expect office capacity to return to 100%? Is that in phase 3 or phase 4?
That might evolve as we monitor what is happening as we begin phase 3. Now, I would say to you, phase 3 is going to be longer than phase 1 or phase 2. You know, we moved more efficiently through phase 1 and efficiently through phase 2 with steps in between the phases. And I would say phase 3 is going to be longer in duration. There's a list of industry sectors from casinos and horse racing to fitness centers and gyms to museums. There's a whole lot of things happening overnight camps. There's going to be guidance around that. We're reviewing youth sports, and at some point we will have better guidance on that. You heard Commissioner Riley talk about that. Indoor events and outdoor events, we're looking at the gathering order now, and that will be released shortly. And in terms of office, that's something that we need to further evaluate. It might not be at the start of phase three, but it might be at some point during phase three that we would change the percentage on that. There are some updates to phase two that we are looking at as phase one and phase two. So as part of that, you will see some changes that we will release to you. I'm looking at office space now.
You had moved it up to 50%, I believe, with part two of phase two.
I think as part of the office space, we might make changes like allow for indoor seating at a cafeteria, similar to and follow the restaurant guidance. In terms of compliance, I'm not clear on what this is saying. In terms of discouraging travel, that would continue. So the answer to the question is more to come on offices. It most likely will be in phase three, but it may not be at the start of phase three.
Very good, thank you. There is just a note from Jessica Bellevaux to us, the panelists, saying that the guidance is going to be posted in the chat momentarily, but also the guidance on outdoor cleaning. Will also be in the summary article of this briefing that will be posted on the MMA website as well. A question, any update on the cocktails to go legislation, which has already passed the House, I believe, and is pending in the Senate?
Right, we were on a call this week with legislative leadership. The Senate president did say that she met with the Restaurant Association regarding this piece of legislation and is continuing to review it. Without a date certain relative to its passage in the Senate. So the hope is that that will be acted on so it can provide a different additional tools to the industry sector, but also to you, should you wish to adopt them locally. We did start the process for in outdoor dining with our executive order, which I think has provided you with needed relief in order to reorganize outdoor spaces. I've been to a number of places just in my short travels here and there, and a lot of people are really enjoying the outdoor experience, even though indoor is open now. I think people are really taking advantage of the good weather when it's with us and getting outdoors. So I don't know specifically when the Senate will be acting on that, but hopefully so.
Okay. Thank you. And for those interested, that means call your senator and encourage them to take it up. A couple of questions left, I'll consolidate. Two questions more on the Shared Streets program. One is, if a community already did some work just before the program was announced, would they be able to get reimbursed for that work if they... or is it a prospective funding opportunity only? And then secondly, what if there are permanent structures or construction that communities would like to do under the grant? Would that be allowed, or would the program be primarily for temporary setup and take down?
My thinking is some of it may be temporary and some of it may be permanent if that's something that can change and allow for more opportunity locally. I really think this needs to be driven locally with what's best for you. I will ask Jess to update around the grant process, whether activity prior to the application opening could be considered for reimbursement. And Jess, we'll get back to you. I saw that from Vanessa Hale.
Yes. Thank you. And then the last question we have, and that means the timing is probably going to be perfect on this week's briefing. And this has to do again with the quarantine, 14-day quarantine period. If the employees are not allowed to return to work for 14 days after going out of state, outside of New England and New York and New Jersey, and then coming back, is the state or municipality obligated to provide paid leave? What is the situation if the person leaves the state on a vacation and then comes back, but then the guidelines say that there should be quarantine,
and they shouldn't go back to the workplace? Between the employer and the employee, what the policy is relative to that time away from the office. That's why the rules are the rules. They are known that if you travel to one of these places, then 14-day is urged for very important public health reasons. And I would leave that up to the employer and to the employee to make arrangements relative to how that employee is compensated for their time out of office and what they would use in terms of time to address that.
One would see that if it's a voluntary action, a community would rightfully be concerned about being obligated to provide payment, except if the person is able to work remotely, then perhaps an accommodation can be made if the person's quarantining in their home, except that that then is disparate treatment compared to an employee who has to physically be present. So it is a complicated area. Guidance as to how the state is dealing with this would potentially be a good model.
We will share that with you.
Very good, thank you. So Lieutenant Governor, you've covered the full range of topics and questions. I know that you and the governor will continue your daily updates and that more information will be coming out later this week. Any closing words?
I just wish you all a safe weekend with the 4th of July. It feels very different. The way we'll be honoring our nation on Saturday. Usually the governor and I are at parades, and think about the number of people we would shake hands with up and down parade routes and people that we would gather with normally. And it's obviously not a possibility this year. And I just wish you a safe one. I hope you find time to just escape for a little bit of time and enjoy your family and friends. And we look forward to seeing you Tuesday, which we can certainly review the phase three at that time and any other questions that you might have on legislative priorities and other topics that are important fiscally as well. And again, just a reminder that the legislative session terms on July 31, unless they extend it. So there's a lot of work that needs to get done in between. So thank you all. I really appreciate the time with you today.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you to the entire team of administration officials who joined us today. This is the 15th COVID-19 briefing that the Lieutenant Governor has provided with the MMA for all of the municipal chief executive officers. Next week, we will return to our normal time of 1 p.m. on Tuesday, the 7th of July, for those that want to see the live update. Otherwise, the audio recording will be posted on the MMA website, along with a summary article and answers to all the questions that are raised. Lieutenant Governor, thank you very much for your leadership, and we hope that you and the governor also have time not to escape, because the responsibilities are always with you, but to relax and have a chance to be with family and friends during this holiday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Bye.